this place intact. Leave all this research behind. They will be able to build another reactor as soon as they replace the scientists and engineers.
If Anna could have seen Alistair's face behind his armored suit, she would not have recognized the man with the evil grin. Who said anything about leaving this place standing? Gonzales, bring it all down. Vega ushered Anna from the room, falling into place behind the reactor-laden Jackson, his escort Kroll, and Tim on point. It was over half a mile to the point where the Scorpions had originally breached the facility, and another 8 miles from there to the extraction point.
Chapter 17 Plan B.
"And I'm done,"
announced Engineer Laris, as he wriggled his segmented body free of the ECM console he had crawled completely into for the past hour and a half.
"Shall we try powering it up?"
the Jiha asked jauntily, failing to notice, or deciding not to notice, the tense atmosphere on the bridge of the Glambring. Captain Cthu flung his own chief engineer a questioning look, only for the man to shrug his shoulders. The Elshaw captain closed his eyes and took a deep breath.
"Permission to power up the detectors, and the detectors only."
Cthu thought about crossing his fingers, as he had once seen his human compatriots doing, but decided against something so uncaptain-like.
"Aye, aye, sir," acknowledged the tactical officer.
Being out of the captain's line of sight, he did in fact cross his fingers as he activated the detectors. With a series of small beeps, the console came to life as the system rebooted itself.
"See, nothing to worry about,"
said Laris cheerfully. Seconds before, the shrill buzzing of the threat receiver wiped the smile from his face.
"Report,"
demanded Cthu of his tactical officer.
"Entropy protect us,"
the man said, as Cthu's eyes locked on him like a laser beam. Clearing his throat loudly, he began his report.
"Two bogeys. Computer is calling Bogey 1 a Hexshaw Ripper-class light cruiser. Bogey 2 is a second cruiser, same class."
"Entropy protect us indeed,"
thought Cthu, as the tactical officer continued his report.
"Navigational radar emissions only. No indication of search or fire control radar. Confidence is high we remain undetected."
"Well, thank the High Being for small mercies,"
thought Cthu.
"They may not know we are here for the moment, but the second Colonel Sinclair's dropships lift off. The cruisers are bound to see them."
Cthu weighed his odds against not one, but two cruisers, and came up with the only sensible answer. A frigate such as the Glambring was outgunned and outmatched, but his duty demanded he try.
"Tactical, get me firing solutions on both cruisers, but remain at MCON 1 until I order otherwise."
The officer for a moment looked like he was going to question Cthu's orders before nodding once and getting to work. A tense silence descended on the bridge, broken only by hushed conversations. Cthu rolled his shoulders in an attempt to relieve the pressure building there, as his eyes followed the two Hexshaw cruisers on his tactical display, like a hawk watching for any sign they had detected the Glambring. He had no way of knowing that the Hexshaw cruisers had already altered the balance of the battle on Cathal. Squad leader Wheeler was trying very hard to disguise his disappointment at being ordered to a hole in the ground miles from where the other Javul of his platoon were engaging those who had dared assault General Pipo's facility. Taking a deep, warming breath of the nitrogen-rich atmosphere, which reminded him so much of home, he stumbled over a rock and was forced to bend forward to keep his balance. It was a stumble that saved his life, as a burst of automatic weapons fire speared through the space where his head had been a split second before. Allowing his stumble to turn into a dive for the hard ground, Wheeler brought up his laser rifle, searching for whoever had nearly ended his life. Bright yellow muzzle flashes from directly in front of him identified the location of the shooter, and Wheeler sent a burst of laser fire in its direction. The ground around him was torn up as the shooter zeroed in on him. At last, the other members of his squad began firing as they formed up in a rough skirmish line, seeking whatever cover was available. A second heavy weapon joined the first, and Wheeler realized that his entire squad was pinned down.
"Well, we shall see about that,"
thought Wheeler, as he dragged his comms unit from his belt.
"Dropship 1-4, Dropship 1-4, this is Squad Leader Wheeler. We are pinned down by at least two heavy weapons. Get off your lazy Hexha asses and give me some air support. Now!"
"Shit, Jonesy, you opened up too early," scolded Kathy Appleberry.
"Yeah, I noticed that, thanks,"
replied Fergus Daw, as he sent another burst of Mac fire in the direction of the Jabul, who had appeared out of nowhere a scant 100 yards from where the two troopers of support platoon had been idling time, awaiting the return of the assault group. The pilots of the dropship sitting at the bottom of the bowl had already decided that there was no longer any need for stealth, and were bringing the ship's engines online in preparation for departure. As the senior of the two troopers, Kathy put in the call to the colonel.
"Contact! Contact! Extraction point is taking fire from Jabul. Approximately squad strength."
"Understood, extraction point. We are 6 miles out. Tell the pilots to warm up the engines for a hot extraction."
"Roger that, Colonel. The pilots are already on it."
"Sinclair, clear." "The Jabul must have guessed our extraction point,"
said Tim to Alistair on their private channel.
"And if they know about the extraction point, then they bloody well know our route to it."
Alistair finished Tim's line of thinking for him, as the older man ran the various scenarios through his head.
"If they manage to bottle us up in the tunnels, then eventually our Caspers will run out of power, and we will have to fight them on foot. And I don't like those odds. Do you?"
"It would not be my favorite way to spend the day,"
joked Tim weakly.
"Okay. Time for Plan B. Take your group plus Anna and Vega, and double time it to the dropships. When you get there, bug out for the glambering."
"Now hold on a minute, Alistair. I'm not going to leave you here for the bloody Jabul to chop you up,"
protested Tim vehemently.
"You, Captain Buchanan, will obey my orders. You will get that reactor and Dr. Wong back to the glambering at all costs. You hear me? At all costs. I will remain here with Gonzales and delay the main force of Jabul and Besquith from catching you before you lift off. When I hear that you are in the air, we will fall back to the second dropship and get the hell off this rock."
"Sir, Alistair, don't make me do this," pleaded Tim.
Alistair slapped Tim's Casper's shoulder with his own armored hand.
"You've got orders, Tim. See you aboard the Glambering for a drink."
Alistair changed channels, effectively ending any argument.
"Gonzales, we are going to make a blocking position here. Let's dig some boulders out of this tunnel wall. Come on, man, move!"
Gonzales and his two remaining troopers jumped to obey Alistair's orders, while Tim scooped Anna up into his large metal arms and bounded off down the tunnel as fast as his Casper would carry him, his small group of scorpions following close behind. The firing in the corridor outside the control room had slackened significantly. Okoro had nearly completed the task that he had set himself, and the lines of code flashed past on his Tribe display at a pace only someone equipped with pinplants and with the aid of his Casper's onboard computer could hope to sustain. The last security system had proved to be a complete bitch. Whoever designed it had meant for it to slow the hacker down long enough for him to be caught, and if the rate of fire in the corridor was anything to go by, being caught was the least of Okoro's worries. The faint rumble of an explosion shook more plaster dust into the already filthy air, and in a side display, the icon that had represented the trooper fighting in the remaining stairwell changed from amber to a solid red.
Okoro's lips thinned. That left only himself and Lieutenant Verley still in the fight. And unless he completed this hack, the sacrifices of the other scorpions would be for naught.
Okoro,
came the weak voice of Carolyn Verley.
I don't know how much longer I can hold them off you. The Jabul have managed to get past us, and are headed down the stairwells to the lower levels. They'll be right up the colonel's ass in no time.
I'm nearly finished. Just another few minutes.
Here they come again. See you on the other side, Okoro.
Out in the corridor, the fire picked up again. The sound of Carolyn's Mac died off as its ammunition hopper ran dry. Controlled, aimed bursts from the gun pod was answered by the fizz and whiz of masked laser rifle fire. Okoro worked frantically, inserting a piece of code here, deleting a piece there, until, all of a sudden, he was in.
I have you now, cried Okoro. Targeting data accessed, fire lock removed, and...
Okoro entered the final command into the Beskwith space-based missile defense system, which controlled all of the orbital satellites.
Missiles away!
Okoro was still smiling when the back plate of his Casper was hit by a dozen Beskwith armor-piercing rounds and a handful of Javul laser rifle rounds. The Scorpion died a happy man.
Captain Poe!
The Hexha staffing the Striking Talons missile detection system shouted.
What is it now?
Asked Poe, more annoyed by the raised voice on his bridge than what the man had to tell him. That changed in a second.
We are being painted by the orbital defense platforms.
Which one?
Poe demanded.
All of them.
Poe looked at him, and his mouth dropped open in disbelief. After a moment, he shook himself and acted, firing out orders as fast as a machine gun.
Shields up! All anti-missile defenses are free to engage as they bear. Comms, warn the Devil's Fang to move out of our engagement zone.
Missile launch,
shrieked the Hexha missile detection operator.
Multiple missiles incoming. Be more precise, damn you,
Poe chastised the man.
How many missiles do you have on your display?
The technician turned, and it looked like he had seen a ghost.
The entire complement of each orbital satellite, Captain. Over 100 missiles.
Poe wanted to reach over and strike him down. What he was telling him was not possible, but one look at his repeater display told Poe the truth of it. Poe was looking death in the face, and he could not escape. Traveling at 36,000 miles per hour, the missiles from the orbital platforms leapt across the expanse of space, separating them from the Hexha cruisers. Defense crews were still rushing to arm their weapons as the first missiles struck home. The Hexha cruisers were designed to survive and fight in space combat, but not the onslaught of missiles they faced that day, all of which arrived within seconds of each other. Computer-controlled anti-missile laser clusters managed to get off a few shots and destroy a small number of the incoming swarm. The remainder doggedly bore down on their targets. Corporal Okoro breathed his last as both cruisers were vaporized.
"What are they waiting for?"
asked Jonesy, as he sent another burst to the Javul, who dared to raise his head high enough for Jonesy's Casper's targeting system to get a shot off at it. The back of the Javul's head exploded in a spray of blood and brain matter, and the Javul dropped face down like a limp rag.
"Who cares? As soon as the colonel gets back, we are aboard the dropship and out of here,"
replied Kathy. She was about to give Jonesy some more sage advice when her suit's audio receptors picked up the high-pitched whine of approaching turbine blades. A shadow flew over her faster than she could react, and her Casper was picked up
and tossed through the air like a rag doll by a series of explosions. Kathy ended up lying in the open, her suit instrumentation flickering on and off. She let out a soft groan as she tried to roll upright, only to discover that where her right arm had been was a bloody mix of metal and shattered bone. Another shadow blocked the sunlight, and Kathy struggled to focus through the pain. A single, high-powered laser round at close range scorched through Kathy's Casper and put her out of her misery. Squad leader Wheela gave the armored monster which had killed half his squad a final kick before walking over to the raging funeral pyre that was the remains of the two Scorpion dropships.
"Well, those lazy-ass Heksha sure did a number on them,"
Wheela commented to one of his surviving squad as he observed the effect of Dropship 1-4's cluster bomb attack. At his waist, his comms unit's beeping demanded his attention.
"Squad leader Wheela,"
he answered, still fascinated by the results of a single pass by Dropship 1-4.
"Wheela, this is Commander Gorak."
Wheela automatically brought himself more upright.
"We have identified those who attacked the facility as humans. They are escaping down the mining tunnels and may be headed in your direction."
"Commander, I have already destroyed the dropships they arrived in and have killed many of their armored warriors,"
Wheela boasted, forgetting to mention it was actually the Heksha who had destroyed the Scorpion ships while he had his head buried in the rocky ground to stop it from being blown off.
"Excellent work, Wheela. We are flushing them toward you, and I have dispatched another squad to join you. Between us, we will make these humans rue the day they took the field of battle against the Javul."
Gorak cut the connection without further ado. Wheela set to work placing his surviving squad members along the rim of the bowl, with an unobstructed view of the mine entrance. Confident his men, with the aid of Dropship 1-4, had enough firepower to deal with any humans who were stupid enough to poke their heads out into the daylight, they waited. Squad Leader Horal sat strapped into his seat aboard the single remaining dropship attached to the underside of Striking Talon. His uncle, Commander Gorak, had put him in command of the replacement squad of Flattar. It was a stain on his honor that he wasn't allowed to command the Javul, all because of Rala Station. Horal closed his eyes as he tried to block out the incessant chattering of the Flattar, who seemed to be incapable of exhausting the list of things they wanted to moan about.
"Hey, squad leader!" called the nearest Flattar.
Horal recognized him as the mouthpiece of the group.
"What?"
asked Horal irritably.
"Is it true we got stuck with you because you're on your uncle's shit list?"
The Flattar in the bay all burst into raucous laughter. Horal bared his teeth and let out a deep growl as he unstrapped from his seat.
"Enough!"
Horal shouted angrily.
"Time for you to learn some manners."
Horal was easily 7 times the height of the Flattar, who realized too late that his attempt to look big in front of his companions had crossed the line, and now Horal was going to do him some serious damage. A warning klaxon reverberated through the bay, and its occupants felt a sudden lurching motion.
"Stand by for immediate breakaway! The Striking Talon is under attack!"
The dropship was flung violently to one side. The Flattar, who were all belted securely into their seats, were bounced around a bit. Horal, however, had already released his straps and was subsequently flung about, crashing into a heavy metal stanchion, which knocked him senseless. The ship made another radical change of direction, flinging the hapless Javul skidding along the floor of the bay until the rear ramp stopped him with a bone-crushing jolt.
"Not so big now, are we, squad leader?"
said the mouthpiece sarcastically. The pain in Haral's back and neck had sent stars bouncing around in his vision, He was sure he had a concussion, and perhaps that explained the words that came out of his mouth before he remembered he was surrounded by armed Flattar.
"I shall crush the life from you, just like that other waste of atmosphere, Diral, and his revolting pet Ziorta we sent to the great beyond. My uncle's right. When General Peepo has finished with the humans, then you Flattar and your cursed Tortantula will be next."
The wide-eyed stares of the Flattar rapidly contracted until they became narrow slits. Suspicion and loathing oozed from the Flattar, and all of them aimed their oversized pistols at Horal.
"Tell us more about what happened to our brethren Diral, and what your uncle knows of Peepo's plans."
Now it was Horal's turn to feel fear.
"Sir! Captain Cthu, sir!"
exclaimed the Glambrings' tactical officer, as he looked around wildly for the frigate's captain.
"What hand has fate dealt us now?"
wondered the El-Shah, as he made his way across to the man.
"It's the orbital satellite, sir,"
the officer said, hurrying on when he saw the shadow of dismay pass over his captain's face.
"They have engaged and destroyed the Hexar cruisers."
"What?"
asked Cthu, as he stared at the man in disbelief.
"And that's not all, sir. The ground-based radars have gone offline. All of them. If I'm interpreting the data correctly, the entire air defense system has gone into a maintenance cycle. We could park the ship right on their heads, and there is not a thing they could do about it."
Cthu let out a very un-El-Shah whoop of joy and jumped back into his command chair.
"Helm, take us down to the pickup point. We are getting our people back."
Alistair did not need his external audio pickups to hear the sound of heavy feet pounding the floor of the mine's tunnel toward him. Even so, he filtered it through the Casper's computer, which analyzed the sound, breaking it down into its component parts, and flashed a number on his display. 36. There were 36 distinct pairs of feet racing up the tunnel toward him, Gonzalez Rivero, and the two remaining troopers of support platoon. Alistair glanced at the names beside the icons representing the two troopers. Colleen Hahn, Irish father, Chinese mother. Alistair had gone up against her in the Scorpion's annual hand-to-hand combat competition shortly after she had joined the company. At 5'1" against Alistair's 6'4", it looked like an easy win. The match was over in under 20 seconds. Alistair really should have done his research on his opponent that day, for Colleen Hahn was a double black belt in Kung Fu, and she had put Alistair down before he even knew the fight had begun. Alistair smiled wryly at the memory. The other trooper, Finn McNeely, was the complete opposite to Colleen. Loud, brash, outspoken, and opinionated were some of the words used to describe the flame-red-haired Scotsman from the small island of Isla. In lots of ways, Finn reminded Alistair of Orrin Blair. Finn liked to drink, and, when he did, you could pretty much guarantee it would end in a fight. Alistair could not remember the number of times he or Tim Buchanan had to go down to the local police station and bail the man out. All that changed the day he met his future wife, Lorna Kennedy. Not only had she put a stop to his drinking and brawling, she had made him into a doting family man. A wave of sadness ran over Alistair. Lorna and her newborn daughter had been aboard the assault flitter downed on its mad dash to the lodge. Finn hadn't spoken of it, even to his closest friends in his platoon. But Alistair knew the man had had his heart torn out. The first Besquith came into view, an eerie sight in the shades of gray of the Casper's image intensifier. The Besquith's mouth hung open, displaying its vicious fangs as it charged the Scorpion's makeshift barricade. A volley of fire tore into it, flinging it backward.
As if that was some kind of signal, a tremendous amount of fire engulfed the scorpions, and a mix of armor-piercing and laser rifle rounds filled the narrow confines of the tunnel. Alistair and his companions returned fire with the same viciousness. In the corner of his eye, Alistair's ammo counter crept steadily down. 200 rounds remaining. 100 rounds remaining. 50 rounds remaining. Rounds expended. Switch to 8mm gun pod. His control bursts raked the waves of oncoming Javul and Besquith, and the bodies piled higher. So high, in fact, that the living were able to use the dead as a sandbag wall. Gonzales Rivero was the first to fall. A line of armor-piercing bullets stitched across his chest. The Casper's armor defeated most of the rounds, but a single round managed to get through and took Gonzales through the heart. Colleen Hahn was next. A group of Javul used the combined fire from their laser rifles to burn a hole clean through the front and back of her suit. Thankfully, her dying screams were cut off as the suit's computer dosed her with painkillers. At least she would feel no more pain in her last minutes. That left only Finn and Alistair to fend off the attacking horde. Finn's Mac, and then his gun pod, ran out of ammunition. His own underarm laser had been damaged during the fight, so it was useless. Rather than await the inevitable, Finn vaulted over the barricade and charged the enemy, his extended blade slashing and stabbing as he went. Finn's war cry was one of the proudest moments of Alistair's life. Charging the enemy, Finn screamed,
"Non quarta!"
Then, Alistair was alone. Out of ammo, and with his left leg badly mangled by laser fire, he used his hands to pull himself hand over hand until he sat propped up, facing the mixed Besquith and Javul force. A lone Javul approached out of the darkness until it stood looking down at the Scorpion's commander.
"I am Commander Gorak. I shall accept your surrender, and will present you as my prisoner to General Pipo, as my gift to her."
Alistair popped the armored cover of his Casper, which opened until Alistair could see Gorak with his own eyes. A large, toothy grin spread across Alistair's face.
"When you see that bitch of a rodent's, Pipo, tell her I'll see her in hell."
Alistair opened his left arm, and a C-6 grenade rolled out to rest at the feet of Gorak. Alistair laughed loudly as the Javul stared wide-eyed at the grenade. The ensuing explosion brought down the roof of the tunnel, burying Alistair, Gonzales, Finn, and Colleen, along with all the Javul and Besquith, living and dead, under tons of rock. Tim's heart sank as he edged closer to the sunlight streaming in through the tunnel's entrance. If his Casper's filters hadn't scrubbed the outside air before allowing it to circulate within the suit, he knew that he would smell the stench of burning jet fuel and scorched metal. Both dropships lay in smoking ruins in the center of the sunken bowl. A myriad of craters pockmarked the base of the bowl.
"Yeah, definitely an airstrike," said Ethan Kroll from beside him. "Cluster bombs, most likely. Looking at the crater pattern,"
Kroll added. Tim did not feel the need to voice his agreement with the first sergeant. Tim did not doubt that whatever had killed their ride was lurking out there, out of sight, waiting for them to pop their heads out, so it could blow them off.
"Well, we can't stay here. That much is obvious," said Tim, more to himself than Kroll.
"The colonel might have stopped the Besquith and Javul from coming up behind us, but you can bet your last credit there are more where they came from. And the longer we wait here, the more likely they turn up. and then they can sit out there and wait for us to die from oxygen starvation.
Or old age,
commented Crow. What? Not understanding the comment.
Well, you are older than me, and I am older than Jackson and Vega. So statistically, you would be the first to pop their clogs if we had to stay in this damn tunnel,
Kroll said lightly. Tim shook his head inside his Casper.
You know, First Sergeant, I don't know what I was thinking when I recommended to the Colonel he'll be allowed to join the Scorpions.
It was my boyish charm, sir,
quipped Kroll.
Tim let out a soft chuckle.
You keep right on believing that. Meanwhile, I'll try to figure a way out of this mess we have got ourselves into.
Both men lapsed into silence as Tim surveyed the lip of the bowl above them. Tim replayed his last thought. The enemy were above them. What if I took that advantage away from them, and instead made it ours?
Okay, First Sergeant. Here's the plan.
Less than 5 minutes later, the four Scorpions troopers were lined up, one behind the other, at the edge of the tunnel entrance. With Vega's help, Jackson had detached the Dustman reactor, which now lay propped against the tunnel wall, beside a nervous-looking Anna Wong. Tim was first in line, and he briefly glanced at the worried picture of Anna in his rear-view camera pickup. He wanted to say something reassuring to her. But when he had tried while waiting for Jackson to get ready, words had escaped him. Now he wished he had said something, anything, before embarking on this last-chance plan of his.
Ready, said last man Vega.
Ready,
echoed Jackson.
Ready,
repeated Kroll.
On my mark. 3, 2, 1,
mark!
The four men sprinted out of the tunnel entrance, and as they cleared the tunnel, they activated their jump jets, sending them shooting into the sky. Tim and Kroll cleared the tunnel before the Javul could react to the unexpected maneuver. Jackson and Vega took a few hits, but nothing that did any significant damage. Each Casper settled into a hover at a height of 100 feet as they scanned the area below them for targets. Squad leader Wheeler had made his men lie prone on the rocky ground to present as small a target as possible to anyone who took a shot at them from the mine entrance. Unfortunately for Wheeler and his squad, they now presented the biggest target possible to Tim and the hovering Scorpions, who gratefully took full advantage of his error. Mac, gunpod, and laser fire rained down on the defenseless Javul. It was over in a matter of a few blood-soaked seconds.
Okay, people, well done. Let's get some dirt back under our boots.
Tim's congratulations were cut off by the urgent screeching of a threat warning receiver. Before he had a chance to shout a warning, the Hexshaw dropship screamed past, twin cannons and its nose mount blasting away at Jackson. The trooper had no chance to evade as depleted uranium rounds bigger than an adult's forearm hammered into his Casper, blowing chunks off it and the trooper inside. Jackson plummeted earthward, smashing into the ground and lying still. Tim's suit's radar tracked the dropship as it banked hard around, preparing to make another pass.
"Spread out!"
shouted Tim. But Kroll and Vega had anticipated his command, and had already moved farther apart to provide a less clustered target for the returning Hexshaw.
"I'm out of mac rounds, Captain, and my gun pod's nearly dry, too,"
called Kroll.
"Push him my way," said Vega. "I'm green on mac and gun pod."
"You heard the man first, Sergeant,"
Tim said as he watched the range to target wind down at an alarming rate. Tim settled the targeting reticule for his MAC on the left side of the cockpit and selected armor-piercing rounds. In the ammo pod below the MAC, the feed mechanism slipped across to the selected type and fed the first round into the breech. Tim held his position as the dropship grew larger in his vision. Wait,
Wait. Wait.
Now!
Tim pushed the Casper sideways as a finger of light flew from the twin guns of the dropship. Firing his own weapon, Tim sent a stream of armor-piercing rounds, which impacted the side of the speeding dropship, cracking off the armored cockpit glass and sending wild cracks across it. The Hexshaw pilot flipped the craft away from the incoming fire, directly into the path of the waiting Kroll. The first sergeant may not have had any ammo left for his MAC or gun pod, but he did have his underarm laser, and he sent a near-continuous burst at the cockpit. The pilot pulled the dropship further to the right, causing the craft to slip onto its wingtip as it turned, exposing its less well-protected underside. Vega let loose with everything he had. 20mm MAC, 8mm gun pod, and finally, his high cyclic laser. Under the constant pounding, the airframe buckled and came apart in midair, strewing pieces of dropship across the unforgiving surface of Cathal. Killing his jump jets, Tim lowered himself sedately to the ground. Anna came running over to him and hugged one metal leg, tears streaming down her cheeks below her rebreather. Kroll and Vega landed beside the tunnel entrance and went in to recover the Dustman reactor.
Oh, Tim, when I saw the Casper falling from the sky, I thought...
Her face dissolved into more tears. Tim looked across to where Jackson's suit had impacted the ground with such force that it was partially buried. The sight of the dead Jackson, like so many they had lost today, made Tim even more determined to get the few that had survived home. Looking over the two wrecked dropships that had brought them here from the Glamring, though, he had no idea how he was going to achieve that goal. Kroll and Vega re-emerged from the tunnel, Vega carrying the reactor. With a touch of his controls, the corporal used his jump jets to take him to the rim of the bowl.
"Captain Buchanan, you better get up here," Vega called over the radio.
Kroll jumped up beside Vega, while Tim walked up with Anna by his side. When he reached the two men, they were both looking to the east, where a low dust cloud appeared to be closing on them. Tim used his suit's optics to enhance the dust cloud, and the slab sides of an armored flitter sprang into focus. Tim felt his head sag as he released a heavy sigh. He was low on everything. Kroll was already out. Only Vega had anything left to fight with. Could he just not get a break?
Captain,
said Kroll, his voice sounding odd, almost disbelieving.
Now what? Has the devil himself decided to add to my bad day?
Not the devil, sir. I think it might be an angel.
Tim refocused his optics on the approaching flitter, only to see a dark spot behind it, which was growing in size at a remarkable rate as it gained on the speeding flitter. Seconds later, the outline of the Glamring emerged from the dark spot. It looked like those aboard the flitter had spotted the frigate thundering toward them, because the flitter's pilot swerved violently. But then, a blast from one of the Glambring's laser missile defense pods sent the flitter and its occupants into oblivion. As the Glambring got closer, it slowed to a crawl until it came to a full stop, hovering directly over the cluster of humans, blasting them with dust and small stones whipped up by the Glambring's engines. A bay door retracted, and winch lines dropped down. The Scorpion's troopers attached them to their suit lift points. Kroll wrapped his arms around the reactor, while Tim gently lifted Anna into his arms.
"Don't you dare drop me, Tim Buchanan,"
she shouted through the mini whirlwind. With a slight jolt, the three Caspers were hoisted through the open bay door, which closed smoothly
after they had passed through, becoming a floor onto which they were lowered. A more breathable atmosphere was pumped into the bay, and Captain Cthu entered, accompanied by Orin Blair, Al, and Laris. Tim cracked his suit and slipped down onto the deck to be joined by Kroll and Vega. Anna stood protectively beside Tim, an arm wrapped around his waist. It was the first time she had been able to have physical contact with him since the nightmare on Cathal had begun, and she needed the intimacy to reassure her that nightmare was behind her. Cthu eyed them one at a time, his expression grave. Eventually, his eyes fell on the dark lozenge of the Dustman reactor. He reached out and touched it reverently.
"I hope this was worth the high price in blood we paid today."
Tim looked at Anna before answering.
"If it gets us back our planet, then any price is worth paying."
"Let's get you lot cleaned up," said Orin. "You all look a bit worse for wear."
"And you smell a bit," put in Al as his whiskers twitched.
"Best idea I've heard all day,"
agreed Ethan Kroll. Orin draped his prosthetic arm around the first sergeant's shoulder and whispered conspiratorially,
"And then, maybe a wee dram, eh, Ethan?"
"It's always drink with you, Orin,"
moaned Al, as he scampered after the two men. Vega tapped at the leg of his suit, which hissed open to reveal a stubby carbine. Slipping it over his shoulder, he took post behind and to one side of Anna. Anna let out a small giggle.
"It looks like my guardian angel is back on duty."
"I think it's safe to stand down now, Corporal Vega," said Tim.
"The colonel said..."
Vega stuttered to a stop. Alastair Sinclair was no longer in command of the scorpions that bore his family name. Tim Buchanan was now the ranking officer.
"You're the boss, sir," replied Vega,
as he unslung the carbine and headed off to find Kroll, Orin, and the promised drink. Laris was busily poking and prodding the Dustman reactor, ignoring what was going on around him, until he noticed it had gone quiet. Turning his head, he found Tim and Anna looking at him.
"I take it you would have no objection if I had this moved down to engineering so I can get a proper look at it?"
Anna waved a hand dismissively.
"Take it. Just don't take it apart until I get a chance to examine it properly, okay?" "Anything you say, Dr. Wong."
The Jiha started circling the reactor again while he tapped away at his slate.
"Penny for your thoughts," said Anna,
noticing that Tim was staring at the bay's blank wall.
"Vega's right, you know,"
said Tim in a low voice.
"About what?"
asked Anna softly.
"Now that Alastair is..."
Tim swallowed a lump that had suddenly formed in his throat.
"Gone. And with no sign of Charlie. It makes me the Scorpion's ranking officer."
A frown creased Tim's forehead.
"Then I vote we find Orin and have that drink with the scorpions that we are lucky enough to still have with us."
"Who said you never have a good idea?" joked Tim,
dancing beyond the reach of Anna's playful swat. The Glambring pulled herself out of the Cathal atmosphere and back into open space. Captain Cthu began to relax until a call from his communications officer brought him back to full alert.
"Sir, we have an incoming transmission from a dropship pilot who claims he is carrying survivors of the Hexshaw cruiser Striking Talon."
The officer cocked his head to one side, as if he could not quite believe what he was hearing.
"Sir, the pilot says he is under duress, and that a squad of Flattar have taken over his vessel
and are now requesting asylum aboard the Glamoring. They claim to have information that the humans that assaulted the Dustman facility may find useful.
Cthu scratched his chin with one claw while he considered their request.
Very well. Allow them to dock, then escort the lot of them to the brig. Let's get through the Stargate and into hyperspace before we worry about what they have to say. Could this mission hold any more twists?
Thought Cthu, as he watched the Hexshaw dropship dock. Its passengers were escorted to the brig, while the Glamoring kept up a steady acceleration as it made its way to the Stargate. As the frigate passed Moon 5, radar reported two contacts traveling at high speed for Cathal. That would be the Besquith, returning to find out what had happened to the facility they were meant to be guarding. Cthu let out a little chuckle.
I would love to be a fly on the wall when somebody had to explain what had happened to General Peepo.
2 hours later, the Glamoring transited through the Stargate, and an exhausted Cthu headed to his cabin for a well-deserved night's sleep. Passing the officer's mess, he heard a caterwauling that could only have been Orrin Blair singing at the top of his voice.
"Let them party," thought the El-Shah. "They deserve it."
Chapter 18 Choices. Tim Buchanan sat quietly at the table in the cramped officer's mess of the Glamoring. The coffee in his cup had long since gone cold, and the steward had prudently left the mercenary officer to his thoughts. The entrance door slid to one side to admit Captain Cthu, and the steward began pouring the fresh apple juice the El-Shah captain favored. Cthu pointed a slim finger toward Buchanan's table and sidled over. Tim didn't notice his presence, which forced Cthu to clear his throat loudly. Blinking in surprise, Tim started to stand, but Cthu raised an open hand, stopping him midway.
"Please, Tim, remain seated."
Cthu tilted his head to one side, while his mouth dropped slightly in the El-Shah equivalent to a chortle.
"In theory, since you have inherited our friend Alastair's position, you are now commander of the mission, and therefore outrank me."
A lazy grin split Tim's gloomy features. "I suppose you are right there, but I've no intention on pulling rank. Besides..." Tim paused as the steward arrived with an apple juice for Cthu and a fresh, steaming coffee for himself before retreating into the kitchen. "We are on our way back to New Warsaw now, and I don't see much happening between now and our arrival."
"Talking of things happening, how was your little chat with our new flatter friends?"
asked Cthu.
Tim gave a wistful shake of his head.
"Those boys are certainly something. They considered their contract to be null and void with the destruction of the Striking Talon, and had every intention of hitching a lift on the next chip headed for civilized space. Until, that was, the Javul, currently residing in sickbay, decided to open his big mouth and blab all about how his uncle, who happened to be the Javul Merc commander, had told him that once Peepo had finished with humans, then her next target could very well be the Flatar. Whether that is true or not, though, remains to be seen."
Cthu took a sip of his juice and savored the bitter taste as it passed down his throat. The El-Shah really should grow apples on their home planet. Maybe he would start his own orchard when he retired. Cutting short his musings, he returned to the matter at hand.
"I take it the Flatar were unimpressed at the Javul's suggestion, thus his residency in sickbay?"
"That, and not being strapped in when the cruiser exploded. Apparently it was a bit of a rough ride."
The Elshah winced as he imagined being within touching distance of a vaporized Hexshaw cruiser.
What about their current accommodations?
Tim shrugged.
They seem happy enough. Their leader, Ural, understands that we just can't let them have the run of the ship. He asked for a pack of cards and some gambling chips.
There is no gambling aboard my ship, I can assure you, Tim, said Cthulhu firmly.
So the bosun's mate assured me. I had to have the cards and chips especially manufactured. When I gave them to Ural, he and his friends started a game. I wouldn't be surprised if they are still playing by the time we reach New Warsaw.
Cthulhu turned to a more sensitive subject.
Was the Dustman reactor everything we hoped for?
Tim nodded affirmatively.
According to Anna and Laris, it performs as advertised. Providing Jim Cartwright can keep up his end of the deal and procure some Ragnar. Or, if we end up relying on Jamie to steal some, then Anna assures me that given time and resources, she can replicate the reactor in sufficient numbers for what we have planned.
The mention of Jamie Sinclair caused Tim a fresh wave of anguish.
How am I going to tell him of his father's death?
He mused. Cthulhu noted the change of mood and sought to lighten things up.
And how are things between you and Dr. Wong?
You know, Captain,
Tim said as he hid a smile behind his raised coffee cup,
I do believe that you are an old gossip.
Cthulhu laughed aloud.
I am only concerned about the morale of my crew, he said innocently.
Of course you are.
Tim grinned. How about we have some breakfast? He asked, smoothly changing the subject.
Excellent idea, said Cthulhu,
beckoning the steward who had invisibly reappeared.
Then perhaps you can share the name of that song Orin murdered last night.
Tim and Cthulhu laughed at the expense of the Scotsman. Kate Priceman felt like screaming, but she refrained for fear of scaring the living daylights out of her bridge crew. Instead, she took a deep breath and let it out through her thin lips. She had made a solemn promise to Alistair that she would find Charlie, his eldest boy. And now she had a difficult decision to make. The Salamanca had arrived in Uyak, where the Zupati freighter carrying Charlie and two platoons of Gamma Company were thought to be, only to find the freighter had departed 5 hours before. Now she must get her priorities right and balance the needs of her flesh and blood family against that of her adopted family, the crew of Salamanca. Hack Voslo, the freighter's second in command, entered the bridge and halted beside her chair. He was close enough that Kate and the Veitch could hold a private conversation if they kept their voices low.
"Have you come to a decision, Captain?" inquired Hack.
He served Kate now, as had his father before him. The human and Veitch pair had developed a bond deeper and more personal than friendship. Often likened to an old married couple, they could hold conversations without actually exchanging any spoken words.
"Are we sure they were aboard the Tlacoz when it left the system? Charlie has his father's knack for subterfuge, and he could well have sent the Tlacoz ahead to Earth, while he hides out here for a while, and then charters transportation on a different vessel at a later date."
Hack remained silent. He knew Kate was not questioning him. Rather, she argued with her inner self to avoid the difficult decision she knew, in her heart, was the right one. The pair lapsed into silence for several minutes until, with a sharp intake of breath, Kate tugged up her sleeves and settled herself more comfortably in her command chair.
"Very well, Mr. Voslo. Prepare the ship for departure. Contact the Stargate and arrange a departure time."
Kate fingered the small key hanging from its chain
under her uniform blouse. The key stayed with her at all times, asleep or awake. The little piece of jewelry contained a one-time encryption code which, when inserted into the navigation computer of the Salamanca on entering hyperspace, would supply the coordinates of New Warsaw, home of the Winged Hussars. Charlie Sinclair's eyes flicked from the slate in his hands to the clock on the wall of the converted cargo pod and back to the slate. 43 hours left in hyperspace.
"You know," said Torrey MacDonald, "there is a branch of theoretical physics which proposes that if you continually check the time, it will actually affect the slowing down of the whole space-time continuum."
Charlie lowered the slate and gave her a derisive look. "And did you know that I have the power to have you shot at dawn for taking the mickey out of your commanding officer?"
"I'm pretty sure that's not in the regs. Stacy is pretty read up on the regs, with her father being a lawyer and all that. I could ask her to check for me. You know," Torrey smirked, "just to make sure my execution is legal and such like."
Charlie flung his hands up in surrender.
"Okay, okay. I will cease the clock watching."
Torrey swung her legs off the bench she had propped them on, while she read the latest maintenance check on her platoon's Caspers. The troopers had unpacked their suits from their shipping crates and were now running system checks to ensure they were at peak performance for what was to come.
"For what it's worth, sir, I think you are doing the right thing. Let's get home and kick some alien ass."
Torrey didn't wait for Charlie to reply. Instead, she spun on her heel and headed to the Casper's maintenance area. Torrey may have been the platoon commander, but like every other Casper trooper, she insisted on doing her own maintenance and final checks. After all, it was her life in the balance if something went wrong with her suit. Charlie watched her go, wondering if, like him, Torrey had someone waiting at home. That person was the real but unspoken reason for Charlie to push so hard to get back home. As the transit clock on the bridge of the Glambring reached zero, the very fabric of space became a distorted, shifting thing, allowing the frigate to slip from hyperspace back to normal space.
"Transit complete, sir."
"Very well," said Captain Cthu. "Comms, ensure we are transmitting the correct IFF codes."
Cthu was acutely aware that New Warsaw was probably the best defended system he had ever visited. If the missiles, ships, mines, and heavy particle weapons all currently trained on his small frigate received an incorrect identification, friend or foe code, it would bring the Glambring's homecoming to a short, spectacular end.
"Codes entered and verified, sir." "Prime Base acknowledges receipt of our IFF code and welcomes us home. We are cleared for a priority approach by traffic control, and Commander Cromwell requests that Colonel Sinclair make himself available to meet with her on docking."
Cthu resisted the urge to turn in his seat and look at Tim Buchanan, now sitting in the chair previously allocated to Alastair Sinclair on the Glambrings Bridge.
"Please relay that Captain Buchanan will attend the commander on completion of our docking."
The Glambring settled gently into its docking cradle on Prime Base. No sooner had the mooring clamps locked and the boarding tube been connected than a human major, dressed in the uniform of the Winged Hussars Marines, arrived to escort Buchanan to his meeting with Commander Alexis Cromwell. Making their way through the vast station, Tim noted the mix of uniforms representing various Earth-based mercenary companies that now called the station home. Neither Tim nor the Marine Major engaged in small talk, and Tim was happy with this. He was sure the Major was a pleasant enough guy, but Tim's mind was more on the upcoming meeting with Alexis Cromwell. Tim had never met her in person. Alastair had handled all the dealings with the Four Horsemen.
Now such meetings would fall on Tim. He wasn't sure he was ready.